Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Yay!
Hooray indeed, guys. Hooray indeed. It's podcast time. I'm Richard Nicholas. Hello. With me to make a podcast is Abigail Bain.
Hello.
Anthony Evans.
Hello.
And Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
So, gang, we watched the same film as we usually do, and now it's time for the chat bit. Anthony, you picked it, so please tell the listeners what the film was and give some sense of what the film is about and who's in it.
Okay. Well, this week we watched a film from 1964 called The Seven Faces of Dr. Low, which sees an old, inverted commas, Chinese gentleman ride into the frontier town of Abilene, Arizona, and proceeds to change it forever as the citizens see themselves reflected in the mirror of his mysterious circus of mythical beasts and figures. It was a film directed by George Powell and written by Charles Beaumont, based on the 1935 novel The Circus of Dr. Low by Charles G. Finney. The film stars Tony Randall times seven, Barbara Eden, Arthur O'Connell, John Erickson, and Noah Beery Jr., to name but a few.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, it's a weird one, because I think we're all expecting something a bit racist from this, because it does feature a man who is supposedly Chinese-ing up, as well as many... He plays lots of characters, in fairness, but it is a bit, oh dear, white people are dressing up as different races, we are in trouble, aren't we? So did anyone else have... Anthony, why did you put it to us then? And we'll say what we're expecting when we saw the trailer or whatever.
Well, this is one of the films I vaguely sort of remember from childhood. Not really. I remember some of the more key parts, which were kind of in the middle of the film, based around the circus. And I didn't really remember anything else. But those images kind of were so odd that I just kind of had to revisit this film. And when I did, I saw that it was prime spoiler-filled material, and you all had to experience it.
Well, it's peculiar, I'll give you that much.
It's an understatement.
It was looking weird from the trailer, I will say. It was looking weird, and I was a little bit, oh gosh, this is going to be terrible as well, isn't it? It looked like there's a lot of prosthetics and characters that look weird and are from mythology, and I was worried about the hokiness of it. It looked a bit weird, and you know, the 60s is a different time. Will there be a little bit of that weird racism? The just weird is like stuff like Breakfast in Tiffany's even has kind of white guy playing Asian, and it's like, oh, that's so horrible. It spoils a perfectly reasonable film.
But
I was worried.
Yeah, the difference with this is though that like Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's is full on just like he's just playing a Chinese man.
Yeah,
for kind whatever reason, they cast Mickey Rooney and they decided you will play this Chinese character. Whereas in this, it starts that way, and like I had the same feeling when he first appears as Dr. Low and he started doing his ridiculous accent. I thought, oh god,
all this the L's, like R's and all the L's. Yeah.
But then there's a point a bit later on when he's talking to the little boy for the first time, and he drops, like the accent's gone. He's still putting on an accent. And it's kind of vaguely Chinese, but it's not that, like, pantomime.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm. And that's when I thought, oh, okay, he's actually, this is something else at least.
I think something that takes off a lot of potential racism is the fact that Dr. Low himself plays many different characters. Like, in the story, Dr. Low is some kind of magician, illusionist, or at least some maniac who keeps changing his costume and doing different people. And so he does lots of different characters with different accents, including, like, Welsh and
you've got
Greek
Merlin,
and stuff,
you've got,
you know.
The Greek fortune teller, Apollonius.
Yeah, Apollonius of Tyana.
And he plays Pan, and he plays Medusa, so he does some cross-dressing as well.
Yeah, it's got all the ticks all the boxes. But luckily, the character is sort of putting it on his accent a bit, so it kind of makes it a bit more okay. It's not perfect, it's still a little bit, oh dear.
It's better
because Dr. Low is a man of mystery, possibly not even Chinese, really. He's this magical entity, and it's kind of better that way than it is him actually portraying
it gives
a standard Asian guy.
It allows, or at least it allowed me to give it a little bit of like benefit of the doubt, because like it's a combination of the fact that it is from 1964, and you know, like you say, it was. It doesn't excuse it. Like when you say, oh, well, it was a different time. Like when you say, you know, it was okay back then, it was, but that still doesn't make it okay.
Yeah. But you hear that, slave owners? It wasn't okay just because everyone was doing it.
Yeah, if everyone jumped off a cliff, which you probably would, history has taught me. But it's a product of its time, and it does kind of play around with this idea that he has all these different identities that are all of different races.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily that he's literally playing like, oh, this is what Chinese people are like, because he's like jumping up and down, fishing in an empty river and going, oh, or whatever. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's the character himself exaggerating what people in this little frontier town would expect of an old Chinese man.
So, yeah.
But then he takes on all these different aspects, and it doesn't excuse it, but it makes it a little bit more understandable, and that maybe they were trying to do something else with it as well, not just be racist.
And it's not mean-spirited. The character's fundamentally the wise one. He is the wise character to everyone. If anything, it's kind of racist towards, people who live on the frontier.
Americans, yeah.
And maybe the Scottish. That was a pretty dodgy accent as well.
That was terrible. All the like American characters, like for the most part, are all proper. Like, you know, well, this old Chinese man, like all like really like cracking, wobbly tear accents and stuff.
A lot of hairy, kind of hillbilly old men as well, with big beards and stupid faces. Yeah. They had normal faces, but they were behaving. They pulled stupid faces and acted like idiots. Abby, what were you expecting when Anthony suggested this to us?
More because of the era than anything else. I was expecting it to be a bit more musical.
It could have been, could have been, couldn't it?
Actually, you're right. The trailer had that kind of musical atmosphere.
I'm glad it wasn't. I fucking hate musicals. But...
Also, it would be asking a lot from... what's the actor's name who plays the seven faces?
Tony Randall.
Yeah. You know, we'd be asking him to sing as well. I mean... It's too much, isn't it? You'd be... I know what you mean, though, Abby. It's kind of... You kind of think, oh, maybe there'll be a few songs in it.
And then I'll turn it off.
Thankfully, no. But I didn't expect this to be about Western. I thought it was just a wacky, weird film about... it's got enough characters in it. You know, mythical characters to be anything. And yet it was like, oh, it's a kind of Western about moralising and... It was a little bit, like There Will Be Blood. There was a similar sort of theme about selling your land to the businessman. So, no one got killed in a bowling alley, but, you know.
No children went deaf.
No, it was far less bleak than There Will Be Blood. But, Abby, you were expecting it to be quite whimsical.
Yeah. And, I tried not to have too many expectations about it, other than... It's of a certain time.
And Anthony's picked it, so it's going to be proper weird.
Yeah.
Okay, so we were expecting weird. We were expecting racism, but actually, now that we think about it, it wasn't that bad. I mean, the makeup, they got like prosthetics on all the characters of Dr. Low, but obviously to be Asian-looking, they had to change his face a bit. And I actually thought it was quite tasteful. It wasn't really...
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously going to make his structure look more like a Chinese man, but it was fine. And the costumes, though stereotypically Chinese, were probably fitting with the era as well.
It, again, to come back to Breakfast at Tiffany's, like, Mickey Rooney in that, from what I remember, is the proper, like, awful, like, buck teeth, like, little, like, eyes, the little hat, and it, like, really, like, full-on, just, you know... There's no excuse for that character and the way he looks and talks and was cast. Whereas in this, it is, like, it's Tony... It's clearly a white person in makeup, but it's not massively, like... exaggerated to the point of being like ugly and strange looking.
Yeah, there's a curve that we're talking about here where you've got Mickey Rooney, you've got the James Bond where they did it to Sean Connery.
I would say, are we in sort of Fisher Stevens short circuit territory, or?
Well, let me finish. I was going to say also when Marlon Brando did it as well.
Oh, and, yes.
And it's just, while still arguably unacceptable, this is probably one of the better jobs I've seen done of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I still think it was better than Fisher Stevens.
It's still offensive, just not so much that it makes me feel physically sick like a lot of the other examples. Yeah.
I think Rich is brought up a good point with Ben from Short Circuit. I think they're kind of on a par where as soon as you're introduced to them, you have the immediate reaction of, oh God, they didn't. But they do kind of such a good job at making their character kind of likable that you kind of forget that they're not like that race.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like all the scenes in this where Dr. Lowe is like a figure of fun, like he's played for comedy. He's doing it on purpose. Mm. Like the character is doing it intentionally. Like the film isn't going, oh, aren't Chinese people adorable and wacky? Like it's not doing that. Like, aren't they quaint and different? Like,
he's like a more funny Mary Poppins character who's come into town, you know. Somewhat magically, he is a donkey sort of appears on the horizon. Like, he sort of appears on a donkey, and just like, well, that's actually more like Jesus than Mary Poppins at this point. But he's mythically appears in this town and has something about him that's unusual. I mean, the fact he has nothing with him, and yet he puts up a massive tent with all these props, and yet he had a donkey to carry it on. Like, he's a mythical guy, magic, there's something weird about him, and he's there to teach a lesson. And many times it felt like a kind of Mary Poppins, I'm going to dick about with the normal people and make them learn a thing or two with a bit of hocus pocus and weirdness. So I'm just drawing that parallel early. Mary Poppins.
Mm. Yeah, I do see a similarity there. I can't watch Mary Poppins, though. Like, I can't get through it. It bores me to tears. I know the hate mail's come in, but whatever. I can't deal with it. Like, as much as I like Dick Van Dyke and as endless hours of Diagnosis Murder I've watched, I can't get past his G'day, Mary Poppins. Like, oh, God.
G'day, Mary Poppins.
It is, Jamie can't watch wholesome things. Can't
you? This is
Super Mario Brothers, the closest to a wholesome family movie that I can watch.
Oh, dear. Speaking of Super Mario Brothers, the snake, the serpent character looks a little bit like Mario with his moustache. If Bob Hoskins had been in it, it would have been the mirror image. No, right, okay. So, Dr. Lowe comes into town, or should I say Dr. Lowe?
No, don't start Nick Caging on this.
No. Or Lau. Maybe it's Lau. I don't know.
They call him Lau, but he calls himself Low.
Okay. So we'll go with Low. So Dr. Low comes into this little, you know, western-y town thing. I don't know what you call them. Cowboy world. Cowboy land in America. And he basically goes to a printer's. It's kind of nice seeing a printer's. It's actually more contemporary than a lot of westerns as well. It's kind of what? Like turn of the century-ish? But they're frontier, so it's a bit more... It feels more dated. But he's in town.
They're still out in the wilderness as, like, technology is, like, sweeping its way across the states, basically.
Yeah, so we establish the characters who work at the printer shop, which is kind of one of the main non-Dr. Lowe-based characters. And there's the guy who runs the printers and the printer himself, and they have this massive thing that churns out newspapers and whatnot. And Dr. Lowe comes in and orders an ad and basically sits politely and listens to some of the main characters have an argument. Because there's...
The political intrigue.
Yeah, exactly. That we have early on. So it's... What are our guys? There's the guy who runs the print shop. Who's he? He's our kind of love interest in a sense and main character.
That's Ed.
Ed Cunningham.
He's a truth-speaking newspaper man. And a young, handsome... devil and he's the sort of lead and then there's the evil man who is buying up all the land with plans to sell it once the railway turns up. That's his thing, isn't it? Make out the land's rubbish, buy it all off the locals and tell them, you know, go live somewhere else. It's rubbish here. There's barely any water. Why would you live in such a horrible remote place? But sell me your land. I'm clearly up to nothing. and his plan is, you know, to sell once the railway gets there and it's worth loads.
Yeah.
And they have an argument because, you know, the newspaper's about printing the truth, damn it. And Dr. Lowe's there to sort of hear all this and be like, I'm going to Mary Poppins the shit out of you guys. You don't even know. Yeah, so, you know, it's an opener. Yeah,
it does a nice job of setting up this, like, central plot and then going out and introducing the other people of the town who all have their own, like, minor little kind of side stories. Like, you've got Barbara Eden's character, and Angela.
Yes.
And her kid, I can't remember the kid's name.
It's always Billy, isn't it? Just Billy.
Yeah, little Billy. And
you may as well be.
Yeah, her kid, and she lives with her husband's mother, and her husband died.
Right.
And her
bachelor's.
And, her husband, like Ed fancies her, and her dead husband's mum is like, you should totally just hop on because it's been a while. Like,
side note, she was also in Mary Poppins.
Oh,
was she?
Yeah. fitting connection.
But she's totally like, you need a good dick in. So
you don't want to get cobwebs in your cooch. I believe is the term the film uses.
It is weird that, like, the mother-in-law of your deceased husband would be like, it has been a while, like, that you've had, like, a stiff one. We need to, like, set you up with somebody.
We're saying, Jess, we're being a little bit naughty here, but I was watching Gone with the Wind, which is very long, and I haven't completed it yet. I found it dull to begin with, but I was very surprised how callous it was about, essentially, a woman marries some bloke because she's jealous of the woman who is getting married early on, and she just marries him because she wants to be married, and then when he dies, she's having a pout about it. And, like, she's just trying to move on as quickly as possible. And it's like, people were jerks, weren't they? Back in those times where women just had nothing to do but get married. It was like, why is Gone with the Wind supposed to be a classic romance film? But it just struck me as, like, horrible. I don't know. That's more of a side note. Weird times, perhaps. Anyway, so we got this woman. We got, you know, the print journalist bloke. And we got the bad guy. And then we got villagers, like, funny characters like posh woman who's going to die alone and miserable.
I'm not going to get ahead of myself here, but Mrs. Cassin has my favourite scene in the film.
It is rather good.
We
got other villagers as well to make up, you know, the background scenes. But there's maybe a few comedy circus punters, I guess. There's like a couple of beardy old men who are kind of cynical, but fun, kind of jolly, beardy. Well, I mean, how would you describe them, Abby? They're kind of...
Who are you talking about?
Abby. Who would you describe? The beardy... Three beardy blokes.
Yeah. The guys who just, like, heckle all the time. They're like Statler and Waldorf, but with a plus one.
And plus beards.
I know who you're talking about, but I don't know who they are.
Oh, I was just asking for a description.
I wouldn't know. Yeah, well, I don't know. The hecklers. That's they go and they take the piss. But eventually they're like, oh, it's all cool and... real.
The whole village is kind of, oh yeah, Mr. Fakey Chinese guy with your magic in quotation marks.
Yeah,
Mr. Conjury Illusionist. Entertain us. We're not interested in your cheap parlour tricks.
Pull a rabbit out of a hat. Oh, you pulled a guinea pig out. Well, that's clearly not as impressive, is it?
Hang on.
They were all massive dicks.
They were. That's the word. Massive dicks with massive beards.
Yeah.
So anyway. And also, were they the guys who were the henchmen of Stark as well?
No, they were separate.
And then there's a Native American guy who they go to beat up, and then Dr. Lowe saves him, and then we never see him again.
He went on to better things. he had to go hang out with the Lone Ranger and stuff. That's a weird noise.
I don't know if that was racist or not.
No, it's just, I don't know. He had a different film to be in, I don't know. anyway, so, you know, those are fundamentally the characters that don't matter, because let's talk about the best one, Dr. Lowe, and his seven bloody faces, am I right? He did loads of people. Or did he? Oh, the ambiguity of Dr. Lowe. Was he all of these characters in his circus? What a mixed posse they were. But, I mean, you know, he kind of heavily implied they were him.
I want to say...
Well, all being played by the same actor,
Yeah, the film, it takes a weird thing, because you never see... Dr. Lowe on screen the same time as any of the era characters, and he's always kind of rushing off like, ooh, I have to be this part now. But that's, which is, you know, it's a nice conceit, but it doesn't really make sense because the people exist at the same time or have to for the film to have worked.
That's what I liked about it. Like, it seemed like he was going off to play other characters, but at the same time they would have to all still be there. Like, I thought it was nice in the way that it played with the idea of what he might or might not be.
Yeah. It's odd, though, isn't it? Abby, I think you were saying to me, like, off-podcast about how, you know, the conceit is he maybe is changing into all of these characters, but only on screen. He never appears the same time, but it also implies that he's in two places at the same time.
Yeah.
Abby. It's also, if he can only do one thing at a time... What are all those people doing in that tent when he's not with them?
Exactly. If everyone is watching Medusa, who they have, for some reason, and they're witnessing her, and then we're watching Dr. Lowe talk to someone else outside of that tent, what are they seeing? Did he stop being her? It sort of breaks its own rule of maybe Dr. Lowe is being these people.
Well, that's I think that was deliberate, though. Because he's a trickster, and he's like... You want to keep this illusion going that he might just be messing with these people, or he might be all these people, or, like, is it the same spirit that inhabits all these different faces or ideas and myths and things? Like, it's...
We couldn't be asked to figure it out properly. So we just... whatevs.
Yeah.
He definitely comes across as magical, because he A, disappears, and B... He does stuff that isn't just the illusions he portrays. Like, basically, when he turns into or has Merlin as part of his circus, Merlin tries to do legit magic, even though Merlin was a wizard, helped, you know, old fictional characters like Archer, I wanted to say. King Arthur. You know, Merlin, I mean, we're very proud of him in Wales. I mean, he's from Wales, supposedly. But this fictional character that Dr. Lowe portrayed or had in his circus was a kind of crap stage magician, which is not I don't know how helpful on the battlefield, you know, Merlin would have been to King Arthur if he'd have been palming like flowers and stuff.
I kind of like the character of Merlin because he was clearly doing magic, but there was no show to it, and because of that people didn't accept it, even though it was real magic. So I like the kind of comment that his character is trying to pass.
It was interesting to have him as one of the faces of Dr. Lowe, who is, you know, some kind of magician. And it's almost like they're aspects of him. Like, that's that part of him that maybe worries about if he'll lose it. Like, or he can't do it anymore, nobody's interested anymore. Like,
Are you digging into the psyche of the actual Dr. Lowe?
Obviously, he's a myth. He's some kind of being. He's not human, and he's existed for a long time. And he's seen a lot of things, and he's been around people for centuries, millennia, whatever. So he's taken on different like ideas and aspects of the things that he's experienced from being with people and being different things and inhabiting different bodies and manifesting in different ways. And each one of these seven faces could be like different aspects of him that have developed through all those years of traveling and
Medusa's the transvestite side of him that turns people to stone when he dresses up as a woman.
He has to, you know, vent his sexuality somehow. That's also what the A Barnable Snowman one is for. That's his animalistic,
it's
rampant.
What are you saying? It's his libido. What are you saying?
I'm absolutely yes.
What about the snake? That's very phallic. Maybe that's the dark, evil, satanic side of him. I've never really thought about the subtext of this. It very much presents it as, aren't these weird people in a circus that are baffling? And now you've started to think about it in terms of his psyche, and I'm a bit scared to interpret it any further.
What's the Loch Ness Monster?
Ooh, because it's a tiny fish, but then when it's out of the water, it's rather big, isn't it? Anyway, go on. I mean, yeah, if you've got more to say on
well, no, that's just a way of looking at it. Like, this is one of those films where the story's quite. It's a not an allegory, but it's like a fable. Like it's a moral tale trying to be told.
Lessons being learned.
So it uses common like problems that people have, and like you have a character who, you know, analyzes different people. So a lot of what would like be subtext, maybe in a more modern film, is just at the forefront in this. Mm. But there are other things that you can potentially read into it as well.
Yeah. Well, if you are a
pretentious film graduate like we all are.
Yeah.
All the kind of shit he cares about and nobody talks about because it doesn't matter.
That's true. Well, let's do that for each of the characters a little bit. Let's talk about each character, because there's seven of them, more or less. I think there's more than seven, actually, trying to do the quick maths. But yeah, so Dr. Lowe essentially just sets up a circus, advertises, befriends a little kid, and gets the people of the village or town or whatever to come and see his wonders in his tent that is a bit like a TARDIS, fairly big, but then it's even bigger inside. It's kind of amazing. Well, actually, it's deceptively big. I don't think it's TARDIS levels, but it's definitely got how is there so much room in here thing to it? And how are there so many characters hidden about in it? But yes, the seven characters. We've talked about Merlin, a kind of sad, older wizard character who does stage magic, and you know, we've mentioned him a bit. Who else is there, guys?
We should probably take them in order, I suppose, of when they're introduced in the circus. So
that would require memory. What if you get it wrong?
I've got one of those, Rich. I do, and a piece of paper telling me things. So the first one is the fortune teller, Apollonius of Tiana.
Are you sure it's not the Abominable Snowman?
I'm pretty sure it's the Abominable Snowman.
It is, but that was so short, it's hardly worth mentioning.
Let's mention him, because he is the shittest, and is not... He, like, he does nothing, he has nothing to
no
him.
Purpose, yeah.
Ugly as piss. In the snow. Like, it's really... He's got an ugly, horrible face. And I like the myth of the Yeti and the Abominable Snowman. And I just thought he put on a band costume at some point? He was basically just a dog's body going and getting things. But maybe one point he had a uniform on. Is that right?
Oh, maybe for the...
For the ending finale parade thing.
So, you know, the Abominable Snowman is underutilized and has little to him other than he's an ugly, creepy weirdo who no one freaks out about.
Yeah, they all, like, take it pretty, like, casually. Oh, look at that white, sharp-toothed monkey thing. Yeah.
But, Anthony, you were saying about the person you perceive as being first. Go on.
Okay, so the first one would be the fortune teller. So, Apollonius of Tiana.
Does anyone know much about this myth?
No.
He was a Greek fortune teller.
Right. I genuinely don't know anything about him, so I think it kind of
explains it as quickly and as well as it can. I mean, we've got a blind fortune teller who can only tell the truth.
It doesn't show that he's blind, though, does it, until the very end?
It's not clear, though, initially. Yeah. He's got his own little room, and he's like a fortune teller. I don't know if you have to pay to get into the circus, and then like all scammy circus things, or, well, carnivals and stuff. You have to pay again to see the extra show thing inside. He's got to make
a living.
He's got all them medical bills.
Actually, yeah, I don't know if he does have to make a living. He's thousands of years old, this fucking scamming bastard.
He's one Asian con man anyway, like playing all these guys. Anyway, right. He's giving fortune. Apollonius is giving, predicting accurately the futures of people, as far as we know. It implies they're true, but we don't know. We don't see what happens to these people. But yeah, he's one of the funniest characters, as I think Jamie wanted to mention earlier. He is probably the best moment when he's giving a fortune.
It sets up all the like the background story of all these different characters, and then the main story about the railway and buying up the town. And Dr. Lowe is like wandering around this whole time, like eavesdropping basically on all of it and like getting a feel for what's going on. And then he invites everyone to the circus, and everybody turns up and sees different things. And Mrs. Cassin, who is this, like, prop. She's like Hyacinth Bouquet.
Sure.
Like, know, that's yeah. pretty much except a widow, like, or whatever. Like, did it.
Oh,
did it
husband... It's sad in that sitcom, Richard dies. And...
like, initially she turns up and she is just played for comedy. She's like, what an unpleasant but funny woman.
I am
a
snooty fat old woman who dresses up like a silly woman. Oh.
Yeah, so Mrs. Cassin is this, like, widower, Hyacinth Bouquet, widower. She's an old man who's just died. And anyway, she believes that, like, men are still falling over her. She's obviously past it, you know, no offense, older ladies. But, she is, and nobody's interested. She doesn't appear to really have any friends. Like, people know who she is, but they avoid her because she's obnoxious. And she's a suck-up to, like, anyone with money. Anyway, she goes in to see Apollonius. Hmm. And I guess she is expecting him to tell her how, like, well-off she's going to be in her later years, and she's going to meet a rich man or whatever. And then he just... up until this point, the film's been pretty light-hearted.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, it has been... Like, there's been a lot of, like, broad comedy. And then he tells her... Even if I say it harshly, it won't come out as harsh as he said.
Yeah, yeah.
No one can match his stone cold honesty.
He doesn't seem to care either that he's breaking the news that you're going to die alone and lonely.
Well, that's the thing, though. He doesn't even. It's the fact that he doesn't say that first. It builds up, so he doesn't just go, "Yeah, you're going to die alone." It starts out with "Tomorrow will be like today, the next day will be like that day." The next day will be like the previous day, and every day is going to be the same. Your life is going to be this monotonous slog. No one's going to love you again because you're old and you're dried up. You'll have, like, she doesn't have any kids, and he's like, you won't have any. Like, that's it now. It's too late. And then you're going to die alone and forgotten.
And yeah, it's like, proper bleak.
Yeah.
Fucking hell. And then, like, and then she goes, anything else? And he goes, nah, that's it. it was so brutal. Like, it was such a takedown, and with no upside. And then, like, she goes outside crying, and then somebody, like, finds her. And the worst part of it is that she then pretends it went, like, oh, I'm going to marry a rich man.
He said I was going to be really happy, and, like, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just like, so sad that she tries to take it on the chin and be in denial. Mm. What I thought was extra weird is he tells her all this, but it's not like when Scrooge in A Christmas Carol gets told and he has a chance to change. He just, that is it. There's no, now that you know that you're going to die alone, you can do something about it. There's nothing you could do. You just know now. Like, yeah. So harsh.
So yeah. You've got that to look forward to for the rest of your lonely life.
Ha 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 ha. Oh, he said I'm good to get married and be really rich and happy. Ha 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 ha.
And the worst, the worst thing is, it's a kind of universal truth.
Yeah,
that we're all kind of tiny little specks in this world.
Talk to yourself.
And it really, it's a scene that really just makes you want to go into a dark room and contemplate your life.
But it's played for lols, Amity.
It plays on that fear that could be anyone. You know, as you get older and you lose people, and no one else is interested, friends or otherwise.
And it's just such a punch in the face, the whole scene.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's other characters as well. who else did we have as part of the circus? That scene with Pan, right?
Yeah, that's
like,
what
obviously, people know Pan. He's the one from the little Bob Hoskins chap from Hercules. You know, he's got feet like a goat.
Danny DeVito.
Oh, it's Danny Vito. It's because he looked like Bob Hoskins in a cartoon form with his little hoof legs and his horns. No. Pan is like a mythological creature, part goat, part human, bit weird.
And plays a panpipe. Sexy man, apparently.
Yeah, he's quite an elongated Pan character because he's human sized. And he's got the curly hair and the horns. And he plays a panpipe, duh. But he has this little room that's got a few bits of like plant life and stuff in it. But the scene they sort of show what he's about to us is the lead female character comes in, all coy, and he starts playing, and then he does a weird mental lust dance that goes into a weird, strange, spinning disco Like, it was mayhem, it was dancing, it was sexual.
He turns into a pan version of Ed.
That bloke she fancies. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. But then, no, I think this is the only scene that I didn't particularly like, because it was like, this is weirdly, like, sexual.
It was certainly one of the most uncomfortable ones.
She was clearly dripping. And yeah.
It was meant to work in the same way that Bollywood dance numbers work, isn't it? Where they represent some kind of sexualized encounter instead of the sexualized encounter. But
you're saying Pan and her did it, but it was to show, they showed us them doing it through dance, or like what?
I'm not sure, but it's that similar neck of the woods.
It's very implied.
Yeah,
but it went on so long.
It goes on forever. And again, the music's really like weird and disorientating. It's like, oh, what's happening? Am I aroused? I don't know.
And like you said, Jamie, the film so far, apart from the Apollonius scene, which comes just before this, it's been so lighthearted and kind of whimsical. Yeah. And then
turning nightmarish.
Yeah.
Weird libido dream, sexual dance with a goat man. The fact that they were reflections of genuine desires being mixed in made it a whole lot darker and creepier and more perverse. Yeah. And then it's just, well, that's over. And other people came in and the illusion was broken. And she's just holding her chest all sweaty. And like, oh my God.
There is another one that I did like was the one with Clint Stark, the bad guy-ish, who talks to the snake that looks like him.
You say snake. This is one of the most dubious pieces of animatronic business I've seen.
The mustache cock. It wasn't. It wasn't animatronic. It was just a puppet.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
I thought for what it was kind of effective.
I was impressed for a film from 1964. You know, which predates the Muppets, right? Muppets was 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it wasn't as cuddly as the Muppets.
It depends what kind of thing you're into.
It wasn't as cuddly. it was weird. It had even though it was one of Dr. Lowe's characters, presumably it was played by him, the guy who played all the parts. But it was a visual reflection of the bad guy.
My assumption is whoever sees it, it looks like them.
But it wasn't played by the actor. It would have been weird because he'd been playing against himself. But it looked like an impression of this bad guy.
The voice was Tony Randall doing Arthur O'Connell's Clint Stark character, but an exaggerated version.
With a giant, creepy, snake-moustached, human-faced... I mean, other people came in, and they weren't even that fussed on it. They were just like...
Because presumably only he can see it. Like, to everyone else, it's just like a big, ugly snake.
It looked like a big, ugly snake to me. That'd be enough to freak me out, talking to him. What was this about? It was kind of like some kind of satanic Bible scene.
Everything everybody sees reflects a part of themselves in there, and that snake is his like honest reflection of himself. It basically tells him you're a fucking scumbag and you know it, and he's like, no, I'm not. He breaks him down as well, because he says, why do you need glasses? Like, you're shit, you're useless, what's wrong with you? Look at me.
Fuck you, snake, you're in a cage, you dick.
Like, Clint Stark is basically deeply insecure, and he covers it with, like, money and power and stuff, and that's what it's, you know, that's what it's saying to him.
Hmm.
It's a twisted fucker, this Dr. Lowe.
He is.
What's he? He's just fucking up everyone's psyches by holding up these psychological mirrors. But not just doing it regularly and reflecting a bit of themselves, but really tormenting them with their innermost doubts and worries.
Yeah.
And desires. Ugh. It was a weird scene. Abby, what did you take away from it, other than deep fear?
The thing with each of the set pieces for the characters is they all went on a little bit too long.
Yeah. Because
it was the only chance he was going to get to be them. So I get it. But at the same time, it's like, you've made your point.
Yeah. And
now you're just boring me to death.
There were a couple as well, like that one. And the one with Pan, as uncomfortable as it was, and the one with Apollonius, all kind of said something about the people who were encountering them.
Mm.
But, like, I'm not sure what the Medusa one was about, with the man with the awful hopeful wife, and then she gets turned to stone.
I think it was about her skepticism and how being skeptic and mean kind of is not what you want to be.
Well, I know, but it doesn't, like, she doesn't get, like, a message.
She actually gets turned to stone.
She is transformed, to be fair.
But I think that one was a little bit muddled. Like it seemed like it was, well, we need Medusa to do something, other than look weirdly like somebody's angry mum from when you were a kid.
Well, see, this is the thing. When they revealed Medusa, the first thing I thought was of the dean from Community, like in fancy dress as he often is. Face, the makeup. I don't know. It was weird. Anyone else see the dean from Community in his face?
Yes.
Good. Not just me. The snakes were a good effect, I thought, on the head. Quite well done.
The Medusa character's fine. It just, she didn't seem to serve as much of a purpose as the others.
Yeah, well, is this scenario that they had was, well, come see Medusa. Yeah, right, snakes for her, and she'll turn you to stone. How are we even going to look at her? No. And then she's got, like, a box and a stuff. She's in, like, a special guarded-off area, and there's a mirror so you can witness her. And, obviously, the Doubting Thomas was this bitch of a woman. who cuckolded her husband. Is that the right word?
No. Cuckolded? No. Cuckolded.
Cuckolded, sure.
I thought cuckolding was when a woman has sex with another man and the husband...
That's true.
Like,
I am just wrong. Yeah. I'm just wrong. Apologies. She was just horrible.
Interesting layer it adds to the film, though.
Yeah, forget what I said. There was no cuckolding. no matter how phallic it got.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar in the mouth of a big cock snake with a moustache.
Yeah, that's right. But this woman was a bit of a dick to her husband. And she was like a skeptic and got turned to stone by actually looking at Medusa. And it was kind of, it went down quite well with, everyone thought it was funny and amazing, I thought.
Yeah.
And luckily, how did it get sorted out? Was it Merlin towards the end? Merlin, yeah. She was just being carted off as a brick. And he was like, I'll sort this. Even though you're all dicks to me, I'll still do real magic.
He does his magic show and everyone's like, and then he turns her back from stone and everyone goes, oh, he's actually good, yay.
Even though we did all see genuine magic and just thought it was shit.
Yeah.
The lesson we've learned from Merlin is do a bit of David Copperfield. Give it a bit of showmanship, you know?
Be younger and open your top a little bit and float around.
Sorry, I think I heard a scream in the background there, Jimmy.
I don't know what he's doing.
It's okay. Weird screams aside, go on.
Yeah, what would have been even better for me is when she gets turned to stone. Presumably, when she got turned to stone, everything did, like, inside and out. So that he would, like, turn her back, but it would, like, fuck up her brain, and she'd just be like, and, like, this, like... suddenly she's, like, crazy, like, out-of-her-mind ogre, just smashing shit up.
You lost me. What? You wanted her to go mental?
Surely it would cause some kind of brain damage. If your brain was turned into cement and turned back.
If he'd have done it all the way through, yeah. I assumed that they made the surface of her stone. Because it still only took two men to carry her, didn't it?
Are we actually having a pedantic chat about the actual turning someone into stone logic and science of how that would work? She turned to stone. She's dead, or it didn't happen. we need to keep the organs alive. She's just encased like that bloke from Star Wars. Oh, he's only one of the most favourite characters. Oh, what's his name? Blokey from Star Wars. Indiana Jones, what's his name?
Han Solo.
He gets encased in carbonite, same thing, isn't it? Medusa'd, he gets Medusa'd. I'm misremembering things.
Oh, but his insides have to be frozen because he's like that for ages.
How are we having a conversation about whether or not...
I don't know. I'm regretting bringing it up now. Let's talk about a different film.
The point is with Medusa, it's a bit... Medusa's bit is a bit weak because there's not much character there. She's just a smug transvestite with snakes for hair and turns people to stone literally and people are fine with it, but... I don't know, the people are a little bit underwhelmed. I would have been baffled by this circus quite early on. And they all seem a bit nonplussed. Who else did we have? Who else? How many have we counted so far? That's like, what, four?
We pretty much discussed all of them with Merlin and Medusa as well.
So that's... So let me count them off. Dr. Lowe himself.
And also the Abominable Snowman, who during all of this does fuck all.
Yeah, yeah, he's not really in it. There's also Nessie, who's a fish in a bowl. There's quite a good joke about, like... Yeah. There's like, but having a fish in a bowl and saying when it comes out of water, it's a huge Loch Ness monster beast, and then never revealing that because it would be a hassle to Dr. Lowe to get it out and prove it. I like the conceit. I like that it came back later and was proven right when the skeptics and the dicks who were working for that bloke came to ruin things. Like, I like that was a nice joke and a nice reveal. But is that a face of Dr. Lowe or no? That is. So what?
No, it's his pet.
So that's not the face, even though it has the faces of Dr. Lowe. When the Loch Ness Monster scales up, this big fish scales up when it's on dry land. Very odd reason for it to do that. But, you know, stranger things have happened in films, I suppose. But it has all the faces of Dr. Lowe. Why?
Perhaps it is Dr. Lowe.
So is it, or is it the other eight faces? Are they, no. So Dr. Lowe, that's one. Abominable Snowman 2, Pan 3, the fortune telling Greek bloke 4, Medusa 5. Who have I left off?
The snake.
Oh shit! The snake. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, the snake.
And so is the Loch Ness Monster
and Merlin.
On Merlin. So yeah, then the Loch Ness Monster, when it has all its heads, that kind of makes 8. But then Dr. Lowe, is he separate from the seven faces? It kind of, I don't know. No, and then there's a bloke, a Caucasian actor, playing all these people. That's 9 faces, guys. It's 9.
What are you talking about anymore?
I just...
There's a guy in the crowd.
There's a guy in the crowd?
That's...
Who
that's,
is him?
That's, yeah, that's Tony Randall. They gave him a cameo.
So that's...
Still confusing, though.
Yeah, it's confusing. There's more faces.
You don't
count
Tony Randall.
He appeared in the crowd.
It's just a cameo.
I don't know. There should be
more
faces.
It's not like a thing of like, oh, but there's the real guy. There's the Hollywood actor who plays him. He's one of the faces. No.
Well, whatever. I just put it up because it's weird.
He's also the little boy and Mrs. Cassin and the fucking donkey.
All right. Sorry I criticised.
What are you on about now?
Anyway, I was just trying to pull apart the numbers and check we'd counted them all, mainly. So those are the characters. I don't know why this... It's quite a weird collection, isn't it? Has anyone got any theories on why these particular ones? Or is it just he could do those impressions rather well? Like, what do you guys think? Why these characters? They don't seem connected other than myth.
Well, it is based on a book from 1935, so I can only assume that they've kind of just taken the same characters out, but may have left some of the reasoning behind.
Yeah, that would make sense.
I'm just wondering who I would have picked to do impression. Like, I think I would have had a Sigmund Freud if I was doing a magical circus to teach people a lesson. I'd have had get a psychotherapy with Freud. Maybe a lecture about bridges from Isambard Kingdom Brunel.
Only because you like saying his name.
I do love saying his name.
Because who fucking doesn't?
I know. I'd probably want Sasquatch rather than the Abominable Snowman. Any of you guys, there any famous characters from history you'd like to appear as the seven faces in your crazy circus?
I'm not restricted by gender, am I?
No, you can have... anyone you want. Or creature, woman.
Tony Randall is restricted by gender.
No. But yeah, you can have, you know, I think I'll add Werner Herzog to mine.
Good choice.
just a general, he would do the voiceover.
Yeah, just a really pleasant German accent to listen to.
Anyway, I can't help but feel we're going off topic here.
No, Abby, bite, have some suggestions, Abby.
Okay.
I need time. I need time.
Maybe keep it for the end. Yes, we're off topic. Anthony, please drive the podcast for a moment.
Okay, well, we've been introduced to all the characters, I suppose, by this point. So what happens next? I mean, it's the next day. There's a scene where the boy, Mike, his name is, has a kind of genuinely sincere moment with Dr. Lowe, kind of like in the middle of all this.
Yeah.
where he just comes up to him and, you know, wants to run away to the circus, and but, you know, Dr. Loeb, being like a 7,000-year-old man, kind of has the wisdom to turn him away and tell him stuff. And just a really nice kind of sincere moment with a lot of pathos.
Mike is just a nice kid, and he just sees Dr. Loeb as this interesting guy and isn't judging him. He's just interested and wants to be in the circus. It is a nice moment, and he talks very soberly to him, does Dr. Loeb. Well, you know, he does spend some time pretending to fish in a dry lake and then succeeding somehow. He does a lot more baffling of the locals.
I think, to mention it, I just want to give props to that kid. I didn't particularly like it first, but then when he was doing that really sad juggling, Dr. Loeb was going away, I forgave him. All of my niggles.
I thought I got a bit Dot and the Kangaroo at the end, where it's like, come back, Dr. Loeb, come back! I could juggle, please, don't leave, yes. Dr. Loeb!
Yeah, it got a bit Dot and the Kangaroo. Come back! No,
goodbye.
Fuck you.
How did we get... There was a second day of the circus, which meant they all got a weird vision, which was kind of bizarre. And I thought a bit of a cop-out. Because the way he converts everyone from there... The ongoing in the story, in the town, is shall we sell our land to this rich, evil bloke or not? And they all have to make up their minds about whether there's value in living there or not. And they essentially just get a little video, a magical video, in an oval. But what, like, it's just a crappy little short film.
It was actually footage from one of the director's previous films. It was a little bit. Well, that's all the fun. Now it's time for a big chunk of exposition to move the plot along.
What was that film like, about?
It was about this town that was destroyed. It was the town that he's in, like, and the different like characters from Abalone were in this like myth that he was showing them, and it was warning them, you know, don't sell out to, you know, these people. And it was just, I don't know, them being shown that, it wasn't like parallel with them being shown things about themselves, really. Like, no. their revelation about not abandoning the town didn't come from the stuff they learned from their individual sessions, and it didn't.
No.
It's just like he went, oh shit, yeah, I am actually here for a reason as well. And I've got a PowerPoint I want you to watch.
What was even in that film? Like, I can't even remember it. It was the least memorable bit.
There's a town by a volcano. A volcano goes off. Everyone dies.
The moral of the story is don't die in a volcano.
Don't live on one, for fuck's sake.
Dickhead. Yeah, I don't know what they were meant to gain from that. The people by the volcano should have sold their land. And the people in the village shouldn't have, because railways come in. We're all going to be billionaires. Woo!
I don't really see how that clears this massive debt that they have at the beginning.
Yeah.
They also have water problems. And also, I don't know. They all seem to get on with it, though. They watched it and went, all of our problems are solved. We're not selling. And even the bad guy just turned around on a dime. Just, I'm going to be nice now. I'm glad you didn't decide to vote to sell your shares of your land to me. Because actually this place is pretty neat. And I'm going to tell you that railways come in and I would have dicked you all over. But no, it's not happening. Let's all be friends and live happily ever. Reading that guy's shit newspaper.
It got really strange, because it's like it suddenly concluded too early so that they could put the Loch Ness Monster scene in the end.
That scene was really weird, because it just cut straight from them watching the video in the circus, and then all of a sudden they just wake up in the courthouse. And nothing's really said, and it's just a really odd moment.
What I didn't get as well is the henchmen, who were like the only two voting yes, we'll sell, to encourage more people. Like, the two henchmen, who we haven't talked about much, well, bugger it, like, just who needs to get into it, but they're just two stooges. But they're still, even though their boss doesn't care and has turned good now, they still are annoyed and want to ruin it for Dr. Loeb, so they're going to smash up his circus despite their boss not having employed them to do that anymore. Like, they smashed up a press earlier as well to sort of add drama, but now they're doing it for no reason.
There are a few instances of few frustrating instances of this film, in this film, of okay, but also magic, and things are just fixed or change because Dr. Loeb is magic, and it like I haven't read the book, so I don't know how different the story is, but like, it almost seems like they write the story into a corner, and then they need Dr. Lowe to go, like, do that little finger thing and just fix it.
Hmm. Oh, you mean his little camp wave? You're broken.
He just meddles with everything, and he just has that little camp magic wave that sorts things and breaks things. But he's basically, these two stooges go to kick, Pan in the dick and do all the Merlin and smash things up and be proper. Yeah. They don't get far because they knock over the fish or?
They like shoot the bowl and then the fish grows into this like stop motion monster with multiple heads. It doesn't, but at one point it does look like it's properly just going to eat them. Like it picks both of them up in its mouth and stuff, and it's like, what? Like, this was the point where I started paying attention again, because I was sitting there thinking, what's happening? What's this trying to tell me in context to the rest of the film?
And it was weird as well, because it didn't eat them.
Just pick them up and throw them around and drop them.
Are you chewing on it? Are you a puppy? What's going on?
Yeah. And then it picked up Dr. Lowe and his legs stayed crossed and he went, whoa! And I was just,
He had that weird rain-making gadget as well, which is like a big, funny comedy box thing. I'm a bit concerned, because I don't know if the listeners are picking it up. I certainly am, but there seems to be some kind of Loch Ness monster attack happening in Jamie's house as we record this. So apologies for the Loch Ness monster in the background.
I'm gonna start including Daryl in the podcast. I'm just gonna have him in the room while I do this, so he can
join the abuse that we're all shouting.
Exactly.
So yeah, this magic box though that Dr. Lowe is just I got this old thing. This works all the time. The magic rainmaker. You just pop it down. Remember this from Never in the story, and he just has to like he gets eaten a bit or chewed like a dog toy while I think. Mike is the one who has to pick up his pipe and light the rainmaker, and then when it rains, hooray, it shrinks down back to being a fish. And I don't know, Dr. Lowe pops in his hat or something, and
it seems a little bit like they concluded the story too early, and they needed more stuff, and they were like, right, what shit have we still got here that we haven't used yet?
I just really want to do a scene where a giant Loch Ness monster with multiple heads of different faces attacks people.
It's like Ray Harryhausen came in to like visit because he was friends with someone making the film, and they went, "Oh, well, as you hear, do you want to knock up a monster scene for us?"
Hell yeah!
And he was like, "Do you need one?" And they're like, "No, but you know,
we're working in. We got the Yeti in there somewhere. He doesn't really come up much." Yeah, I was a little underwhelmed. Although, you know, it's quite good animation, but for the time, you know, like, it's a bit, what the fuck is this story? I mean, the whole thing is kind of, what the hell is going on? And, it all just wraps up fairly neatly at the end with everyone's happy
and
now.
And then he decides he's leaving.
Yeah, because the wind has changed and he's pissing off for some reason to the next village of idiots who might sell their land. To teach them the lesson of you're all messed up.
Well, I'm off to save someone else, maybe, kind of.
I'm just going to fuck with people's psyches and freak them out somewhere else, because I'm a dick.
I've saved a whole town, except one or two people who are probably going to kill themselves after this.
Yeah. Yeah, sad, but true. And then he rides off on his little donkey and vanishes and leaves Mike juggling and crying.
Mike, who now grows up with the trauma of being not only losing his dad, who died when he was a small child, but also now this old man that he's come to look up to. Can I join your circus? No. Bye.
He's got a new father figure, though. They hooked up, those two people we don't care about.
And he can juggle.
Yeah, he's learned that skill. That'll be handy when he's digging in a mine or whatever else he has to do for a career.
Yeah, it's Arizona. He is probably going to be working in a copper mine.
Making the railroad. Actually, it's funny that Dr. Lowe turned up ahead of all the Chinese people who are going to presumably build this railway. It was nice of him to bugger off before he could help his fellow men out.
Yeah, before he could actually be of some proper use.
Maybe that would have been the better thing for him to do, instead of moralising, is to actually help people who are enslaved, or at least being treated very badly. Ah, whatever, though. Hey, whimsy. That's what it was, apparently. How did the love story end? I mean, they just they had a talk for a bit, didn't they, in the rain, or was it? I don't even remember.
Yeah, suppose I'm someone else who has the same name as me. Fancy a shag? Yeah, all right.
That's the edge to the conversation.
Pan got me like
hot under the collar enough
that you can shove your whole forearm at me at this point. Like,
jeez. and work me like an animated snake. Or a puppet snake.
Oh, God.
Is this going to happen every time you go past 9 o'clock?
Yeah.
just post watershed, say anything I like.
Hey, the internet doesn't have a watershed. Yeah, where Jamie's from.
Oh, you're saying that at 20 past 3 in the afternoon.
Yeah.
Get all that fist up. Arm it was. God, Lord. Jesus. Right.
We're like a hat.
Oh my, totem pole that bitch. Oh, okay, let's get a grip.
Anyway.
The point is, Anthony, the film was horrible and terrible in every... No, it was baffling and weird. It was weird. But thanks. Thanks for that.
I don't know, it's a lot of people, which surprises me, I don't mean this to denigrate the film, but a lot of people do seem to look at it as kind of a classic. And I can kind of see why, just in, like, the makeup is good, the special effects are good. The story is good to a point, but it does just kind of collapse in on itself. Like, forgets where it's going
it
and just rushes to the conclusion.
Sorry, yeah. It just rushes to the conclusion, yeah.
Yeah.
And it doesn't capitalise on one guy doing quite a good job. Like, there's one guy here working his socks off, and he's actually being quite different characters. You forget sometimes that he is all these roles. You know, a little bit, and he's quite a good performance, and you know, it's just kind of a shame to have wasted it, because it is fighting a hard battle of racism and terrible effects and makeup, and yet, you know, it's quite heartfelt most of the times. Dr. Lowe is probably the best of his characters, which is surprising, because it's, you know, a white bloke being an Asian guy, and that's weird, but it's effective. He's quite good. I'm kind of surprised that they, you know, it could, in a way, with a few tweaks, it could be more of a classic in the, along the lines of Mary Poppins, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, other hokey westerns.
Yeah, it just...
It's a little bit clunky, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit... I don't know, it's not... It could have been streamlined, or it could have been... And it might just be because of its, like, being based on a book, again, and I haven't read the book, so I don't know, like... apparently, like, Tony Randall didn't like it. Like, he wasn't proud of this film.
That's the politically correct thing to say now that we're further away from... Yes, I'm not proud of it. I'm proud of myself.
It could have been that it didn't do great at the box office, because it was kind of a bomb.
Yeah.
I think he should be proud, because it's a lot of effort, even if the end result wasn't brilliant. He, I think, put the work in.
There you go. The quote is, "It wasn't a very good film per se, but I'm more proud of that than most of the things I've done cinematically."
So, I've had too many rape scenes. I'm such a horrible bastard in movies. And at least I was innocent to some extent in that.
I guess he was proud of it. It just, I would imagine, being able to take on that many roles. And yeah, he does a good job. And like, racism and things you could read into it and it being that dated aside, he's still a fairly likable character if you can forgive the kind of, you know, image it portrays at certain points.
Yeah.
And there is some depth to the film. It definitely says things about certain characters that are in it.
Yeah.
But I think it, like you said, it doesn't capitalize on it. Like, it doesn't take it. It's not a natural progression from him picking apart certain characters to the town realizing what, you know, what they should do, the right thing or whatever. It just suddenly goes, oh yeah, and that needs to be tied up.
There's a lot of arbitrary decisions to the plot and characters, and even the characters in it are sort of arbitrary, and even the more, they're just, what happens all the way through is sort of arbitrary and just odd and without focus sometimes. So anyone else got any final thoughts before we come out, before we decide how many heads out of 7 it is?
I chose it mainly because of the Tony Randall performance. I mean, it's, you know, 7 different characters in a film is a ridiculous task, and he pulls it off brilliantly.
That's right, Eddie Murphy. It's a ridiculous task. You shouldn't do it.
And while, like, yeah, you're right, the film is very... It's not a classic. It's very bitty. But I found it very provocative at moments. Hmm. And I think there's stuff in here that once you've seen it will kind of stay with you for a while.
And if it had been a darker sort of modern comedy, some of that stuff with, like, the fortune-telling would have been, like... Well, that would have fitted in quite a, you know, modern comedy.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of potential in it, and there's a lot of good ideas in there, and some of it's very well done. It's just, it's not consistent enough.
Hmm. Abby, what do you think? Final thoughts?
Yeah, there was stuff to like, but it just didn't come together in the end.
And like a lot of the films we look at as well, tone was a little bit all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
It's getting to the point now where that almost goes without saying.
The world of mediocrity which we're so fascinated by. Just the middle films that aren't too bad and aren't too good. They always have tone problems. They can't be one thing or the other. Because if something has a consistent tone, it's either shit or good. I think that's the problem. So, everyone, let's go with 7 heads out of 10. I personally give it 3 heads out of 10. I give it the head of the Greek guy. What was his name?
Apollonius.
Apollonius was a good head. And so was Merlin. I thought Merlin was funny. And I thought Dr. Lau was good. So it can, 3 of the heads were good. And overall, the film is kind of 3 out of 7. You know, better than 3 out of 10, obviously. But still not quite there. That's what I would say.
What's half of 7?
3.5
heads.
Can't have 3.5 heads though. That's kind of grim.
7. You could have the fish instead of the Nessie character.
Yeah. I would give it like 3.5. I would if I was going to be allowed to rate it out of 10.
No.
Seven, like a normal person,
how many
I would
heads
give it 5.
But because,
so 3.5.
Yeah.
And I would say the fortune teller, Dr. Lowe, Merlin, and then like half of Pan's head, because
that was scary.
That's what I mean though. Of all the other, characters other than the 3 everyone likes, Pan I think is the one that had the most potential to be another really cool one.
Yeah, because it's like, it sort of says a lot, but it's much more deep and sexual and disturbing and kind of intriguing as a character.
I'll put half of his head in there.
He's half human and half goat. You can have the human half of the head.
And just because it's like there's more to him than the other like more forgettable ones.
Snake bitch and
I thought the snake. I didn't know.
Yeti bloke.
Well, the Yeti was just he could have just not been there. But whatever. 3.5. Fuck you.
Fuck you too, buddy. Abby, how many heads out of 7?
I'm gonna say 4 heads.
Okay, that's generous. Generous.
I'm not going to attribute heads.
did you think of any more people you'd like to have in Abby's crazy circus? Who would you turn into to freak people out?
My 6 other faces / whole people.
Yeah,
I have made a list.
Oh, I'm glad you were quiet now because it's meant you've been busy. Also, thinking of can I make a guess? Because I think for Pan instead of Pan, you could have Daniel Bryan, the goat-faced wrestler. Just a thought.
There are no wrestlers on this list.
Oh. I would guess that at least one of them was going to be Kane.
Bobby, who are your 6 heads of the
Kane?
Who are the
Clancy Brown?
this is what she would see. She would see Clancy Brown and Kane if she saw Pan. She would have a fantasy about them. Abby,
do you want me to
answer
or not?
I'd love to hear you.
I would be the MGM Lion, Calamity Jane, Pinocchio, The Little Mermaid, Miss Price from Bedknobs and Broomsticks, and the fortune teller from Big.
That would be like your animatronic-y, puppety one, I guess. Well, that's a list. Well, I don't know what that says about you, Abby, honestly. some intriguing choices. I think we leave it to the listeners to decide what they think of that. I'd go to that circus. The circus of Dr. Bane. That'd be your brother's circus, actually, come to think of it.
Yeah, what? If you guys can't think of any, we can always add them into the blurb later if you like. If you want,
I pray we don't, because that would be that would be 28 faces. We'd have to go. Anthony, you can have the final heads out of 7.
Okay. I think I'll have to give it a 4 as well. And if you're going to make me choose which heads, I suppose Dr. Low, Apollonius, the giant serpent, and maybe Merlin. Definitely not Medusa or the Abominable Snowman.
I like the guy with the mustachioed freaky snake, though.
Hmm. Oh, I kind of liked that.
I did as well. I felt bad for leaving that one out.
But I want to bring up something I kind of found, an analogy I found whilst doing some research for Dr. Lowe, which I thought was kind of really apt for it. Yeah. So it's essentially, it's like going to a kind of rundown-ish Chinese buffet and ordering 7 very different, not necessarily Chinese dishes, and putting them all together on one plate. You're going to enjoy some of them. You might not enjoy all of them, but it's definitely not a representation.
It's a buffet of foreign food, and you're going to be a proper British person and get chips.
Well, you got to, haven't you? I mean,
yeah. Well, apparently you do. Like, I think, it doesn't matter where you go.
I think if it was a buffet, like Anthony says, maybe the dumplings were spiked because it was properly weird. It was not a normal buffet by any.
You may be leaving with salmonella.
Another thing I was thinking in terms of analogy is I felt like, other than like Mary Poppins, I thought Dr. Lowe was a lot like Richard O'Brien in The Crystal Maze. Like, he's got all the punters going around his maze doing all the challenges in his tent, you know? And he's just popping in to see how they're doing, but basically off doing his own thing and being a dick. And I felt there was a kind of Richard O'Brien Crystal Maze vibe to it at times.
I like it.
Yeah, I see it.
Definitely, because of his dickish nature as well, that's how Dr. Lowe came across, as just, like, abusing all these poor people and having a laugh at their expense.
And he was a transvestite at one point in the film, so...
fits into the whole Richard O'Brien ethos.
He's a transvestite.
Not all the time. But he's fond of them.
No, but he is one.
Not all the time.
That's a weird thing to say, because you either are a transvestite or you're not.
When you say he's a transvestite?
He wears women's clothes. He had an operation so that he has breasts.
Did he?
I think this is a revelation that we should save for Rich for when we finish the recording.
Did he, though?
yeah, he was on
how
the
recently news
a couple
was
years
this?
Ago.
How long? Ages? I didn't know this. Yeah.
I think it's probably a little bit misleading, because in all of the stuff that we've seen him in since, when it's been like sort of DVD extra type quality things, he tends just to be in sort of generic loungewear. So
yeah, I think I saw him on this morning, pre anything going on, and he was just a slight... He still looked the same because he was old and bald, but he's always looked bald. So, anyway, this is just now a chat. So Jamie's going to catch me up about Richard O'Brien. And I think we're leaving the podcast... Sorry?
Ravishing Rick. That's what he used to call himself on the Crystal Maze.
Ravishing Rick Rude. I'm getting really confused now.
Let's wrap up.
The podcast is over. I am going to learn what's happened to Richard O'Brien. And, you know, check out Dr. Lowe and his 7 faces if you fancy it. Or if you have, you know, seen it as well, let us know your thoughts. Any number of ways on the internet to communicate to people. Feel free, and we'll say goodbye.
Toodaloo.
Bye.
Bye.